danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 196 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. From Melrose, Massachusetts, I'm Nate Mavis, and with me from Catonsville, Maryland is Andrew Brokus. How are you, Andrew?
I'm good. I imagine we have a great show to bring people today. Don't yet know who the guest is going to be, but wanted to take this opportunity to at least record our introduction, our strategy segment, while we've got the chance. But we definitely have some good people I've been working on, and who are coming along the pipe. So hopefully we'll get one of them today, for this episode. But in any event, you can expect to hear from some pretty good guests soon. So stay tuned.
Yeah, remember when we started the show and we thought, like, well, we can get these, you know, four or five people on. Maybe if we try really hard, we can get two or three of these other people. And then we'll see just how long it lasts. And I've still got a long list of people that I still want to talk to. And we've had, I counted them up not too long ago, like well over 100 unique guests.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And I mean, I've really been impressed at how many people, will say yes when at. Like, I think for the most part, the trick is just, like, getting poker players' attention. There's very few people who I've, you know, gotten to know from. And I think in most cases, when people haven't responded, it's just been a matter of them, like, not seeing the request. I don't have great means of, like, cold contacting some people, and it's probably not the best way of, or certainly not the best way of contacting some people. But yeah, I've really been, pleasantly surprised and flattered by how many people who don't know anything about us, have never heard the show before, were still like, oh yeah, sounds fun, we'll try it.
Yeah, so thanks to everybody again.
There is one thing I'm looking forward to, which is by the time people hear this, it will be open, but the new MGM casino at National Harbor is about to open. And this, to be honest, is not necessarily, like, overall great news for me, because, I've been kind of on and off crashing at my mom's place while I'm in between homes. And in any event, you know, I'm here a few times a year when I visit her, and Maryland Live is, like, super convenient to her house, like, 20 minutes, even with, like, slight traffic, I can still get there in, like, 20 minutes. So it's, like, it's really, really good. And Maryland Live is, like, a great place to play poker. Like, the games are, I wouldn't say consistently great, but even having, like, a reasonable chance of getting a good 10-25 game, I think makes it one of the better poker rooms in the country these days.
Absolutely.
And National Harbor is probably, especially for the high stakes action, seems very likely to just, like, move immediately to MGM. I mean, unless they, like, really screw things up, it's certainly the plan of, like, the higher stakes players to move the game there, which makes sense, because I think a lot of the money that's fueling that game is coming from DC anyway, and, like, it's more convenient to those people and whatnot. So the scuttlebutt anyway is that it's going to be sort of like a bonanza when it opens, and I've never really been around for, like, apparently it's, you know, generally pretty good when a new casino just, like, opens and starts a new poker room. I've never been around for that before, so I'm kind of looking forward to that, and it'd just be, you know, fun and exciting. But it is going to be, like, a much longer commute for me to go down there. I'm actually even so it's, there's, like, the grand opening is, like, 11 p.m. on Thursday night, which I'm not going to go there for. I think I am going to go Friday night, and I actually booked a hotel nearby, so I won't have to drive back and forth, because it's, like, an hour without traffic, and the Baltimore DC traffic can be really, really bad. And so if I'm going to play Friday and Saturday, I think it is, like, a reasonable investment to just stay in a hotel down there Friday night.
Absolutely, 100%. Also, every time a room opens in a new market or a slightly new market or a modification of an existing market, I remember, 6 or 7 years ago now, when I was playing 50-100 mixed games with, among other people, Mickey Appleman, and somebody came up and started talking about Florida, which had just raised its cap. And Mickey Appleman, who had not said anything for hours at this point, turned around and said, "Yeah, I hear that's a berry patch." So it's not really a story, but it is, like, my one Mickey Appleton experience. So, Andrew, I hope it's a berry patch.
Yeah, I think at least in the short term, it should be pretty nice. But in the long term, you know, I think it's going to hurt a casino that has been very good to me.
Yep, absolutely. Agreed on all counts. and also agreed that trying to get from DC to Baltimore is bad. I got in a traffic jam once on that road at like 2 a.m. just
that's the thing. There's really not, I mean, there are worse times, but there's almost no time when you're like guaranteed to avoid traffic. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah,
I mean, there are times when you're guaranteed to hit traffic, but it's hard to have a guaranteed no traffic.
Yeah, good luck. How does it feel to know you're like unusually likely to lose $20,000 or something in that game? Like, it's hard to be in a spot where you're gonna like be willing to lose that much money in a cash game, right?
Yeah, it used to be more common for me. Like, I've actually been playing somewhat lower stakes for the last couple of years. Than I mean, like, kind of at the height of my play, I was playing like a fair bit of 25/50 online. So, you know, there was a time when I was like reasonably accustomed to swings like that, and I think I've to some extent lost the stomach for it, but I don't think entirely. I think I'm still capable of playing pretty well despite eating some big losses. I have tested myself in that way before.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing I always think when I sit down in an unusually good game. Speaking of that 50-100 mix back in the day, it's like, boy, it's real rare that I'm willing to lose as much money as I'm willing to lose today. I could really lose a lot more money than usual. Good luck me.
Well, we both have some things to plug before we get to the strategy segment. Do you want to go first?
Yeah, small thing. I am now writing occasionally and editing a little more occasionally for a site called gonfalonbubble.com. It's a new project. It's eclectic.
Spell the way it sounds.
Yes, GonfalonBubble.com. Gonfalon Bubble, two-word phrase from Casey at the Bat. There's a lot of baseball stuff on there, but there's also other stuff. There's some fiction. There's some nonfiction. I think a lot of it's funny. Some of it is intended to be funny. Some of it's not intended to be funny. It's eclectic. It's fun, and a lot of smart people are writing for it. It is headed up by former guest Matt Sinkowitz, who a lot of you will remember. He's a communications professor at BC, has a lot of things to say about baseball and politics and race and movies and things like that. So, gonfalonbubble.com.
And my thing is I am once again participating in a year-end fundraising drive for the Bay Area Urban Debate League. Some of you who've been listening for a long time may remember this from last year. A lot of you contributed last year, which I'm really, really grateful for. So this is a nonprofit organization with which I've been deeply involved since I've lived in the Bay Area. I've volunteered with them in a variety of capacities. I'm a donor to the organization myself, and I'm even a member of the organization's board of directors. So I can attest that this is a group of people who are doing good work. It's an organization that I personally believe in, and one that, you know, I've invested a fair bit of both time and money in. And you know, I'm also personally invested in the activity of debate more broadly. I think that joining my high school's debate team changed my life in a lot of ways. Among other things, I think it gave me skills that make me a better poker player and teacher, maybe even a better podcaster than I otherwise would be. And in the 15 or so years that I've been working with urban debate leagues, I've seen them change the lives of a lot of kids who go to troubled schools, who live in troubled neighborhoods, who come from troubled homes, and it really is a good cause to support. Beyond the intrinsic benefits of do-gooderism, I do have some other stuff on offer. So first off, anyone who donates $20 or more will be entered into a drawing for some great Thinking Poker-related prizes. Still working out some of the details on those, but last year that included stuff like free items from the Nickcast store, free membership at Tournament Poker Edge, even an opportunity to discuss a hand with us on the air. And actually, Nate just mentioned when he saw this in the show notes that he was willing to volunteer, what did you say, Nate? Two half-hour blocks of coaching for winners?
Yes, 2 half-hour blocks of coaching are in the pool of prizes. So, yeah, you can win coaching with me.
Which may or may not be a prize, but...
Yeah, no way of knowing, but some people seem to like it.
So on top of prizes for individual donors, for every $1,000 raised as part of the campaign, I'm going to put out a free one-hour strategy video. And I'm going to do my best to line up some exciting guests to help me with those. Last year I did videos with Dara O'Carney, Gareth Chandler, Daryl Jace, and of course Nate here. So last year we raised over $5,000. Hopefully we can beat that this year. And again, for every $1,000 that's raised, I'm going to put out some free strategy content. Two ways that you can donate. You can go to Razoo, which is razoo.com and search for my name, which is Andrew, A-N-D-R-E-W, Brokos, B-R-O-K-O-S, and you'll find my fundraiser on there. You can see the progress that we're making. Or you can go to thinkingpoker.net, and there's a link. There will be a link in the notes for the show, so you can just follow that link directly and get to the place to donate. Remember, it's for a good cause, and the more we raise, the more free strategy videos you'll see. Looking for a great holiday gift for the poker lover in your life? Or maybe you're the poker lover and people never know what to give you? Well, drop some hints about Tournament Poker Edge. For as little as $25 a month, you can give or receive the gift of poker knowledge, and that's a gift that keeps on giving. Sign up or direct your gift givers to tournamentpokeredge.com. And speaking of holiday gift giving, if you're doing any shopping on Amazon, you can help Nate and me out by using the Thinking Poker affiliate link. Just go to thinkingpoker.net, click on the Support the Podcast tab, and choose the right link for your country. It won't cost you anything extra, but it will generate a little kickback for Nate and me. All right, on to the strategy. This hand is coming to us from Ricardo, who listens in Brazil and plays poker in Brazil and lives in Brazil, I assume. This hand played in a 5-cent, 10-cent game on PokerStars, 5-cent, 10-cent Zoom game specifically. Ricardo says these games are usually pretty tight and aggressive, and there's a lot of good players there. I have a little trouble. I mean, I think the quality of play in Zoom games tends to be a little higher than it is in regular speed games, and I know that games have kind of gotten more difficult across the board. I still have trouble. I mean, I imagine Ricardo and I maybe just have, like, different opinions of what exactly we would mean when we say good player. I think that if I truly believe there were, like, a lot of good players there, I might have some different opinions about how this hand plays out. So I guess I just want to put that caveat in there. But I think it's right that, like, it's not going to be as super fishy as, you know, people who played 5-cent, 10-cent maybe, like, 3 or 4 years ago would probably have a flawed idea of how fishy this field is going to be. So to that extent, I think that's probably true.
Yeah, I've played some small stake Zoom on Bovada and also some higher stakes Zoom on Bovada, and it's amazing how similar the two games played. There was a lot of difference at the top end. Like, the best players at, you know, whatever, $1, $2 Zoom were quite a bit better than the players at the micro stakes Zoom, but there were a lot of, you know, sort of ABC tightish players at the smaller stakes, and I imagine that the PokerStars games are quite a bit tougher than the Bovada games. So I think that when Ricardo says good players, we should hear sort of ABC tightish before the flop, aggressive and straightforward after the flop, you know, probably playing, you know, 73 tables, you know, guys like that.
Yeah, that seems right. So our hand, Ricardo says, I hold King of Spades, Queen of Diamonds on the hijack, playing a $7 stack, and I opened to 25 cents. The button has $9 and calls. The big blind, who covers both players, calls as well. So we go to the flop with 76 cents. Oh, actually, I mean, I don't know if there's really anything to talk about preflop. I mean, I think this is certainly a hand you should be opening from the hijack. I don't think preflop raise sizing is particularly interesting to discuss, so, but I guess I'll just confirm, Nate. Anything you want to talk about before we go to flop?
Nope. Okay. On to the flop.
So the flop, with our hero holding King of Spades, Queen of Diamonds, is King of Clubs, 10 of Clubs, 3 of Spades. 76 cents in the pot. Big blind checks. Any reason why we might want to do something other than bet here?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think no. There will be times when the button is betting a lot at this spot. Like, for people who call preflop with a lot of Broadway cards and re-raise at least sometimes, if they like to bet the flop, then they're going to be betting this flop a lot, and the money will go in better if you check than if you bet. And that's not just sort of a hypothetical. That's not just me making things up so that a play is right. That's actually something that happens quite a lot in games I play. But those games aren't Zoom games, and we don't know a lot about this player. I think it'll get checked behind a lot if you check, and I think good things happen if you bet. So I would bet.
Yeah, I agree with that. I would pretty seriously consider checking King Jack if I had that, and I would have that. So I think, like, sort of whatever the worst top pair you could have, I think is often a hand that will play better as a check call than as a bet, which kind of makes sense because, like, if you can't have worse than King Jack, people don't really have incentive to call you with worse either. So, like, I think when you, if you bet here with King Jack, it's hard to get called by hands that you're way ahead of. I mean, you'll get called by hands that you're slightly ahead of, like draws, but I think that there might be a little bit more value in playing a hand like King Jack as a bluff catcher. But I think because we can have King Jack, I think King Queen, and like opponents can have King Jack, I think King Queen is strong enough that we want to be value betting it. And Ricardo does bet. He bets 40 cents into a pot of 76 cents. I would probably err on the side of betting larger here. I don't know that I'm really capable of talking about multi-way pots in too much of a non-exploitive way. But I think, like, for exploitive reasons, if just we think about the hands that are likely to call a bet, you know, I think anyone who has Queen Jack or two clubs or a dominated king is not going to be terribly price sensitive for a difference between like 40 cents and 60 or 65 cents. So I think, like, we expect to be ahead when we're called. We want to put as much money in there as we can. The only hands I can really see it making a difference might be like 10x and maybe like a Jack nine or something in terms of like whether somebody floats with a, you know, like a gut shot, you know, maybe it makes a difference betting 40 cents versus 65 cents. But I think just to try to like induce those kinds of looser calls, we're giving up a fair amount against the hands that are very likely to call larger bets. So I would err on the side of betting bigger here.
Yeah, I agree. And I also want to get back to the game conditions here, which is that even as these micro stakes games have gotten tougher, I think one area in which there's a big difference between smaller stakes and larger ones is bet sizing, both making and interpreting those bet sizes. Mm-hmm. And so I think there aren't that many people who are going to fold for the extra, you know, 17 cents or whatever it is, in part because it's 17 cents, which is not a lot of money to a lot of people who are playing these games.
Yeah, that's a good point. Ricardo bets 40 cents, and the button min raises to 80 cents. Big blind cold calls. And Ricardo says, at this point, I thought about raising, because I think I could be ahead. However, I thought the big blind's call seemed a little bit suspicious. I know there are only a few combinations of hands that I could be behind, specifically pocket threes and king 10, but I thought that if I raised here, I could be inducing a shove from a range that would include both a combination of draws, two pairs, and sets. I don't think anyone is likely to have ace-king, pocket tens, or pocket kings, because those generally get re-raised in this game. I know that the few hands that I'm behind are rare, but I just didn't want to risk it yet, and I thought that calling would prevent a high variance spot where I go all in with top pair against some combo draws. And that all seems more or less correct to me. I think it's sort of like if you were to raise here again and all the money goes in, like, I think you should expect to be up against a pretty strong range. And you're right that it would include a few hands that you're in okay enough shape against that you might not want to just, like, 3-bet fold the flop. But you also are not making a lot of money 3-bet calling. Like, basically, you're just kind of turning a strong hand. You're sort of killing the value of your hand. Either you win the pot immediately, in which case, you know, you probably were very likely to win the pot anyway, or you sort of put your money in like a pretty close to zero EV spot, which is not a super exciting prospect.
Yep, I agree.
The one thing I would add here, just when we're thinking about the big blind specifically, I wouldn't rule out hands like King 3 or 10-3 suited. You know, he's getting quite a good price to call from the big blind. If I'm in his shoes, I'm certainly calling with those. And I think they might even be reasonable hands for him to cold call. There's only a few combinations of each of those because the 3 is not suited with the king and the 10. And I think like king 3 off and 10 3 off are not so likely to call preflop, but I would throw in a few more combinations of hands you could potentially be behind here. So, yeah, I mean, I think what's happening here is like we still have a pretty strong hand. It's strong relative to our range, but it's not so strong that we want to be building a huge pot with it. So I like the decision to just call here.
Yeah, I do also, and we have far too much hand to fold, even though we have a reverse implied odds hand in some sense, just because the big blind could be calling with a lot of, you know, some weaker made hands. He probably shouldn't, but I think he will, and certainly some draws, and the button could be testing the water with worse hands also. And even if we're behind, you know, it's a reverse implied odds hand, but we can improve. We can hit a king, queen, or a three. All those hands are, you know, they don't give us the nuts, but they make things pretty good. So, yeah, I think we certainly have to call, but we shouldn't be surprised if we fold, you know, sometime before the end of the hand and possibly even put zero more cents into the pot.
Turn is the seven of diamonds, making the board king of clubs, ten of clubs, three of spades, seven of diamonds. Our hero holding king queen without a club. There's $3.06 in the pot. Hero has $6.24 behind. Ricardo says, I don't think this turn changes anything on our range. I decided to bet fold the turn because I believe any hand better than mine would just shove, especially those in Button's range, since Big Blind would have odds to call with his draws. Plus, I could value bet against draws and worse King X. And this, I think, is kind of the most controversial part of the hand, because what you said before, Nate, about we might not even put another penny into the pot, I think... Well, I mean, it's obviously inconsistent with betting again here. And I'm a little on the fence myself about whether or not this is a good bet. The one bit of new information that we have, well, actually two bits of new information we have compared to, you know, three betting the flop, which, you know, if we're going to, like, we already kind of made a decision on the flop that we didn't want to put another bet in. So I think the way to think about this is, like, what changed on the turn that now maybe we do want to put another bet in. And the two arguments I can see... that have changed. One thing is we now know what the turn card is, and we know that it's not a spade, it's not a nine, it's not an ace. Like, it doesn't complete any of the draws that are out there. So draws have gone way down in equity, and that's helpful to us. We've also seen the big blind check, and there's some reason to believe that even if the big blind were slow playing a hand better than ours, like a set or something, he might on the turn, because now, like, the seven puts up another, like, an open-ended straight draw. Not that anybody's that likely to have 9-8, but I think a lot of people just sort of, like, look at the board and see a lot of draws and get afraid of getting sucked out on or whatever. So I think, like, the big blind weakens his range a little bit by checking here, because... You know, some people sometimes will bet if they have better hands. So I think our hand has gone up a bit in value, both because it, you know, a blank is in some sense an improvement for our hand insofar as it doesn't improve draws, and we've got a little bit of a show of weakness from the big blind with that check. But I'm genuinely curious your thoughts on betting versus checking it.
Yeah, I think it's close. I think everything you said is really good. I think the min raise indicates a medium strength made hand often enough that I would certainly be tempted to bet. I think if I can bet fold confidently, that's a great reason to bet the turn. It's not conclusive, but it means a lot. Not just fold correctly, but fold happily, and that's, you know, something you can't really know in a Zoom game, but you can have a sense of how the game plays in general. I think I would probably check. I mean, the raise and the cold call, it means a lot. I think some of the value you can get now, you're going to get on the river. You only have one more card to come, so I think that you aren't giving the draws too much equity. I think this is a legitimately close decision. I certainly wouldn't bet call, so bet folding is where it's at, I think. I worry that especially in the modern state of these games, it's going to be hard to get value from a lot. I mean, folding out draws is nice, but I mean, at least compared to giving them a free card. But I think that I don't know, like, is king nine offsuit gonna call? Is king nine suited gonna call? I don't know. I think some of those fans find a fold. Certainly a hand like jack 10 I think will find a fold on the turn. So I worry that we're throwing money into the pot a little bit loosely if we bet this turn. That said, I like Ricardo's reasoning. I think it's a very justifiable play. I think this decision is close.
Yeah, the thing, I mean, if you remember what I said on the flop about, you know, king jack being a good check calling hand, king queen is kind of the new king jack, right? It's the weakest king that's now in our range. Assuming that we're check calling king jack on the flop, then king queen is like the bottom of our value betting range on the flop. And it should, you know, especially with getting raised on the flop, we really shouldn't be able to continue, I think, with 100% of our value range on the turn. Like, there should be some hands that were like thin enough value on the flop that once we get a raise and a cold call, they're no longer hands that are strong enough to bet for value. That's that's sort of at the theoretical level. And this comes back to my point about like just how good or how tight aggressive are these players. I think that the stronger the players are, the more likely I am to check the king queen. The more that I think people are just going to be a little too stubborn with like top pair, maybe even second pair and draws, and also be a little more like straightforward and, you know, to the point where you can like very confidently fold to a turn raise, then the more I like Ricardo's bet. And I think Ricardo has some pretty good reasoning behind his bet, and, you know, I think that he, despite, you know, my disagreement with the way that he framed the games earlier, like, he certainly has more experience in these games than I do, and if he's thinking this is like a pretty safe bet fold and worse will call, I would trust him on that, and I think that it probably makes sense to bet.
Yep.
So he bets $1.80, the button calls, and the big blind folds. This, I think, is very good news. I think with the button having, I think Ricardo is right that with the big blind having cold called the flop, the button is quite unlikely to keep slow playing at this point. Among other things, there's like less than a pot size bet left in the stacks. Hero could have a draw himself. Big blind could have a draw. There's a lot of good reasons for the button to raise if he has a hand better than king queen. So I feel pretty good about us having the best hand once we don't get raised on the turn. And I think that I don't know that there's many rivers I would want to check fold. I think it would have to be a river card that completed all of the draws. You know, it'd have to be like the ace of clubs or the nine of clubs. I don't know that there, maybe like jack of clubs is pretty bad also. I don't think there are too many other rivers that I would want to just give up on. I think with so little money behind, I'm planning on shoving most rivers.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I worry about getting some tighter folds, like and by tighter I can mean a hand as bad as, you know, jack 10 or something like that. That said, the money probably goes in better if you bet than if you check. I would consider a small bet also.
That's true.
Especially in these small games, like, you know, specifically a hand like jack 10 or 10-9. Mm.
The river ends up being the 10 of hearts, which is kind of an interesting card because it does pair the board. So that makes the final board king of clubs, 10 of clubs, 3 of spades, 7 of diamonds, 10 of hearts. Our hero holding king queen without a club. And Ricardo says, I believe that although this card seems like a scary card, any 10x hands would have folded the turn, so it really is a blank on our remaining range, unless the button holds king 10 and decided to just flat the turn, which, you know, I would add there, although that's technically true, like, you were already losing to king 10, so the 10 doesn't really change even that. Also, with big blind folding the turn, I believe he could have some combination of draws that decided to not call the turn, or even a worse king, although that's less likely. So the big blind could actually have had some hands that blocked draws being in the button's range, which makes it less likely that the button would hold a draw. And I think that's some really sophisticated thinking. I think it's right. I mean, if you think about what kind of hand did the button fold, or what kind of hand did the big blind fold, it was probably either a 10 or a draw, and those are like the two hands that we would potentially benefit from not shoving into on the river. Sure. So I think that's a very clever analysis on Ricardo's part.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Ricardo says, I decided the button could have some king x hand, could even be ace x, but also king queen, king jack, maybe king nine suited. I decided to shove the river. He could sometimes call with worse king x, and maybe fold king queen, the famous Nate Mavis two-way bet. Although I don't believe he would fold ace king. I know that I could check call to induce a bluff on the river, but I didn't want to risk him checking behind king jack or even king nine suited. Also, the fact that big blind blocked some draws the button could have would make smaller the amount of draw combinations in button's range, which are, you know, just to make clear Ricardo's analysis here, which I think is very good. Like, those are the hands we'd be trying to induce a bluff from. We'd be trying, like, the reason to check call rather than shove would be if we thought we were more likely to induce a bluff from, you know, like a jack queen or busted clubs than to get called by a worse king. And if we believe that the big blind folding takes some draws out of the button's range, then, you know, we're less likely to run into those kinds of hands. So Ricardo does shove, which I agree with. I think his analysis here is really, really good, and it really gets at a lot of points that a lot of people tend to miss in terms of, like, what is the reason to check call the river? It's not just because we have a medium strength hand. It has to be, you know, in order to induce bluffs from specific hands, and I'm really impressed with Ricardo's analysis on that. Anything you want to say, add here, Nate, before I give the results?
No, I think it's a bad time to induce bluffs, and I think it's a good time to induce bluff catches. I think we have a good bluff catcher. This is
I love it. I'm gonna steal that for sure.
Yeah, it's nice, especially with the 10 pairing. You're just begging him to say, like, what? All the draws missed and the 10 paired. What do you have? King 10? No, I don't put you on that. Like, and I think if we're betting here, it's likely to be a bit thin. So, yeah, I would go ahead and catch that bluff catch.
Yeah. Ricardo does shove. The villain tanks a bit, calls, and also has king queen. So pretty anticlimactic result that chopped the pot. But I think the analysis here is really, really good, and I hope that some people learn from it. I would say even I probably did. I don't tend to think a whole lot about blocker effects of people who folded. And there's a lot of times when it's difficult to, you know, where that's not that relevant. But I think it is actually pretty relevant here, and I don't think that's something that would have occurred to me. So very well done, Ricardo, and thanks for writing.
Yeah, I mean, if you play this well, like, if his thinking is this good over the table, he's not going to be a 5-cent, 10-cent for long, I don't think, even in the modern
that's
day.
That's kind of what I was thinking when I was like, what do we really mean by good players at 5-10? I was like, well, this guy's there. Like,
boy, this is, like, sort of dead on. I mean, I don't agree with every word of it, but that was pretty solid.
No, like, in all honesty, like, this is better thinking than I'm accustomed to seeing from, like, I mean, there's a fair number of people at 5'10 who can't think through hand this well.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah. No,
even
I mean, half the time they're like, 5'10. What if he has a flush draw? Like, yeah, this is very good. And like, and if he doesn't play this well and is putting in this kind of effort away from the table, also good, also a very good sign. Yeah. And boy, I by the way, I consider myself something of an expert in writing better than I play. I think it's a thing I do well.
So I try to, like, stay out of all these little dramatic things that keep happening in poker, especially on Twitter, because I feel like Twitter is fun and should be, like, jokes and animal pictures and just, like, a little bit of, like, needling your friends or, like, rooting for your friends. And I try not to, like, make it this big, serious thing, because I think that's what makes Twitter suck a lot of the time. But I just, like, lost my mind. It was, like, 4 in the morning, and he, like, Marty had written just so many things that were, like, thinly veiled jabs at, like, a lot of the people in poker that I really like.
Not even veiled, just jabs.
It was, like, there were jabs at them, but, like, I think what I mean by thinly veiled is, like, they were clear personal attacks because they had said things about Marty.
But he would pretend that they were about something else.
Exactly. He's like, oh, well, this person did this, and this is why I'm criticizing them, not because they said my writing sucks. And I just, like, got very tired of not saying anything, especially when he's attacking Kate and Ike and Justin Bonomo and calling them social justice warriors because they're, like, trying their best to give a shit. And so I just wrote, like, a long Twitter note that was, like, criticizing him for basically calling, like, every poker player that I know a low life, delusional waste of life. And a lot of people felt the same way, and, like, a lot of people showed support for it. And Negreanu posted something that obviously, like, his voice is very loud in the poker world and on Twitter and everything, and it got a lot of steam, and he ended up getting let go by Poker News, which, like, actually makes me feel pretty bad. But at the same time, like, he was, I don't know. We're his target audience, and he's telling us we're scum. So I don't know. Like, if anyone, you know, deserves to get let go, that seems like an offense that is worthy of firing. But still, I don't know. I was like, after that, I was like, all right, back to making jokes on Twitter. I'm out of here.
Well, the point, I don't know if you know this guy, Alex Weldon. He writes for Part-Time Poker, and we've had him on this show before, actually. But he wrote a piece that I really liked, and kind of his argument was that sort of the main reason to fire Marty is more just that he was essentially just insincere. Like, you know, because his defense all the time is like, oh, I don't necessarily even mean those things. I'm just trying to, like, stir the pot or whatever. And that, like, even though that probably wasn't their actual reason for getting rid of him, like, that's a pretty shitty way to be a journalist.
Right. That Alex Walden is Benefactum Games on Twitter, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
I read that article today. I thought it was awesome. I thought he's like very fair in his discussion of it, and it's clear he's not a huge Marty fan, but like the way he like parsed out the subject, I was like, this makes a lot more sense. Like, if I had longer than a tweet, that is like what I meant, you know. It's just that I don't know. I'm not going to spend like 4 hours writing a blog on why I think that what he wrote was terrible for poker and for all these people. And I honestly, this is not BS, but I have found way more charitable people in poker than I did in any other occupation I've had so far, including law. Like, people, when I was a lawyer, like, there was a lot of drive and dedication to making money for yourself, and making partner and like building this like awesome life. And these people were workaholics, but they were workaholics for themselves. They weren't doing stuff for charity, and it didn't even feel weird to work 12-hour days and not even consider, you know, what impact I'm having on the world, if I'm going to do something good with this money or anything. In poker, I feel like it's brought to the forefront so often, like, oh, you're playing a game for a living where you take money out of other people's pockets, and like, what are you going to do? You don't do anything for this world. And like, I think that that's like ignited a fire under a lot of my friends' asses, and they've started charities. They donate every time they win, you know, they'll put a percentage every time they win. And I just think that I think poker gets a bad rap, and I think that there are actually a lot of like really good people in poker.
Yeah, I think that's right. Although, you know, I have like a pretty skewed view because, you know, I really only know the lawyers who like donate and volunteer, but I've done a fair bit of work with, they're called Urban Debate Leagues. So it's like starting, after school debate programs in urban public schools. And there's a lot of lawyers who are former debaters themselves. And so, you know, the organizations that I've worked with, a lot of the, donations and volunteers, come from lawyer, from the legal world. So like, I'm personally familiar with a fair number of lawyers who are, you know, pretty actively involved as volunteers and or donors, but obviously I have no sense of like what percentage of the legal world that is.
Yeah, no, that's awesome that you brought that up though, because like, I don't want to be like the Marty for lawyers. Like, I don't think lawyers are scumbags, you know? Like, I think that
that's going to be the title of the show.
Yeah. I think that like, in law, it was like, it was just easy to get wrapped up in your own world and like be so busy and working so hard that you're not even considering the things that poker players consider because they have free time. And I'm sure there are a lot. I mean, that I was in private law, like I was doing corporate basically. So, you know, the drive to make money is huge there, and the drive to like climb the firm ladder is so huge that I don't think people like donate a lot of their time or money, to charity. But obviously there are like tons of great lawyers, like even like what Selps is doing now, like, and Kate with like donating time, you know, even for like the election recount for ACLU, other projects. Like, there are definitely a lot of great lawyers. I'm just generalizing. I see how Marty gets wrapped up in it. Like, it's easy to be like, all this group of people are lazy and uncharitable.
And I know we kind of talked about this last time, but I don't fully remember the answer. I mean, was that part of your reason for leaving the legal world? Like, was it a lifestyle thing or an attitude thing or both?
I don't know why I went to law school. Like, I just got a good LSAT score and I got into a school that I really wanted to go to, and I didn't think too far ahead. I was just young and like was just happy to be in school more and not working more.
Right.
I think I just didn't think it through. So like, when I was a lawyer, I was like, oh man, is this really what I want to be doing? That was like the first I really thought about it, was when I started it. And I realized I didn't want to be working like 60 hour weeks on something that I wasn't passionate about at all. Mm. So that was kind of it. It was just, I don't know, like a lot of the people in my firm were like super workaholics and so driven by work and success that like, I was like, wow, I could see enjoying this if I was like that much of a type A personality. But I just realized I'm like a little bit too chill.
So do you feel like you don't approach poker in that way? Like the same sort of driven type A kind of approach?
When I started, I did. Because I just was like, I was used to working so hard as a lawyer that I couldn't even deal with like having free time. It felt weird. Like, I'd be sitting on a couch and I'm like, am I really going to just like watch a show? Like, that's odd. So I started out and I like read a ton of books and I like worked really hard in the beginning when I was like super crazy about poker. I didn't want to do anything else. I thought it was awesome. But that's definitely waned, and now it's like, I think I put in like a decent amount of work, but I know people who work way, way harder than me.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same way, and I feel like I'm in the minority in terms of, like, I'm doing this because I don't want to work too hard at something. Like, if I really wanted to, like, put in 60-hour weeks or whatever, like, I could certainly make more money elsewhere. But I think, you know, more and more we're seeing it is, like, the Federer Holtzes and the Patrick Leonards and, you know, the people who really are just, like, that's the thing. I mean, Federer's maybe not even the best example because he's retired or whatever now. But Ryan LaPlante, like, people who are, like, poker is really just, like, the thing they want to do, and, like, being great at poker is their sort of, like, the thing they want to put all their time and effort into.
Yeah. And I think, I don't know, I think maybe seeing how, like, people at the top of the game sort of move on from poker at some point. I was like, I don't really want to, like, go nuts and for 2 years, like, be the hardest working person, make a bunch of money, and then get burnt out from something that I love. Like, I still enjoy this game. Like, I'm going to go play cash tonight, and, like, I'm looking forward to it. So, I don't know. I have done that with other hobbies, just completely burnt myself out. I think that I should be working harder, but I don't see myself ever being like the putting in 4 hours of studying a day before an 8-hour session or anything like that. Like, I don't have it in me anymore.
What does studying look like for you when you do decide you're going to do some, like, away from the table work? What form does that take?
I'm a big fan of, like, run it once videos. I think that that's, like, a really easy way for me to learn. Everyone learns in different ways. Like, some people have to have, like, this, like, intensive review of, like, hands. They'll take a hand and take 2 hours and put it through, like, PO Solver and talk to 14 different people about every street sizing and whatever. Like, I kind of like watching a video where someone's giving me, like, an overview of a tournament they won. There's just so many great people on Run It Once, and Tournament Poker Edge also. Like, you can find a really good random hand history review. But for me, mostly, I have a house with my boyfriend, and we have two housemates who are all pretty serious poker players, and whenever one of us has, like, a deep run in something, we'll try to, like, go through hands and kind of leak bust the other people, and that seems to work really well for me.
So he's a poker player also?
Yeah. How can I date a civilian at this point? I'm too weird.
I mean, I do think, like, especially if you're a female, it's sort of like the fact that you're able to, you know, like, talk intelligently about poker should make you, like, an overvalued, like, you should be of, like, extra value to men in the poker world relative to, like, men elsewhere.
I don't know, maybe. Yeah, oh, well, that's kind of a thing, too. People are like, oh, these girls are just poker hot. I'm like, I don't care. Like, I'll take any kind of hot. No, that's never an insult. It's supposed to be an insult. I'm like, well, whatever.
There's a saying in Silicon Valley about women's experience on the dating scene that the odds are good, but the goods are odd. And I wonder if that's what you found in the poker world.
So awesome. I've never heard that before, but that's so funny. Yeah, like, the, like, times I've been single in between, like, long relationships in poker, I have heard that, like, oh my God, it just must be so easy, like, to date in poker. I'm like, yeah, to, like, find dates would be easy, but to, like, find someone that you want to date is not that easy. Because poker is, like, it's a weird world where, like, you know, like, strip clubs and dating massage girls and, you know, like, literally hitting on every woman that walks through the casino, like, that's, like, the norm for most of my friends, which I find no problem with at all, except I just don't want to date someone who's, like, hitting on everything that moves. So it's kind of, yeah, it is kind of weird. I'm not going to complain, though, because I think it'd be much, much harder to be a guy in poker trying to date girls, like, with all the traveling and, like, trying to explain the weird lifestyle of, like, no, I was really playing poker till 5 a.m. Like, try telling that to a normal girl. It'd be so hard.
Yeah, I think I was fortunate. I was with my partner before I started poker, so she kind of, like, came up in it with me. So she's kind of had a lot of the same, just, like, getting used to the various weirdnesses of poker. She's been able to do that at the same pace that I have, more or less.
That's good. As long as you have someone who, like, really trusts you, I think it's fine. I think starting a relationship where, like, you know, in the beginning there's not a whole lot of trust, you just kind of, like, hope the person's nice, I think it'd be really hard to, like, explain to a girl, like, this weird lifestyle and the weird hours you keep and, you know, that you really are doing what you say you're doing. And I don't know. And also explaining gambling, like, you know, that there's a difference between playing blackjack and playing poker, that you have, you know, you have a chance to win. You're not, like, just wasting your time and hoping to win. I think that'd be really hard to explain to a woman who doesn't play at all.
Yeah, I think especially the first time you have to talk about numbers. You know, like, I think you can just say, like, well, I won or I lost, or you can sort of explain the idea of, like, well, you just kind of put in hours, and sometimes you win and sometimes you lose, but you sort of have a rough sense of how much you might be making per hour. But at some point, you, like, the question is going to be, like, so how much did you lose last night? And, I imagine that's just an uncomfortable conversation.
Yeah, I could see, like, breaking down, a chart. If you show them, like, Poker Journal, the app, and you're like, look, I'm making $68 an hour over this many hours, like, that would be okay. But if you said, like, last night I went and played 2-5 and there was a straddle and so I lost 2,000. No big deal though. It's only really like two buy-ins. They'd be like, what? Like 2,000? That's like what they're making in like a couple weeks of work. I was like, that I think would be really difficult to explain.
Yeah, I find that tricky when people, you know, especially if you like catch the main event and people are like, whoa, that's like how much I make in a year. And I'm like, okay, but have you ever like lost a month's salary in a night? Like,
yeah, I like that too. I still have a decent number of like normal friends from law school and before that, and I'll get messages like, wow, like you cashed the main this year, like what are you gonna buy? And I'm like, that's so cute. It sounds great. You're like, wow, you cashed for like 30k. I'm like, yeah, but that's like the year before that I didn't cash it. I plan to play it again next year. There goes the 30.
You said you're going to play cash tonight. You're No Limit, or you play other stuff?
I just play No Limit at Borgata. They have, like, some kind of promotion going on, like a high-hand thing that, like, drives a bunch of people to the casino. And I was in a rut where I was playing online almost every single night. Because we have three sites now in New Jersey, and they're all pretty good. So you can have a decent number of tables up. And I was just doing it every single night. And then at some point I was like, man, I don't feel like I like really play poker anymore. Like unless I go touch chips and cards and like talk to people, I start feeling like, you know, it becomes a little too much like a job when I'm always staring at my computer. So this week I've been put in like three live sessions and they were fun. So I'm going to do that again.
Well, and you're sponsored by Borgata now, right?
Starting January 1st. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so that too, it's like good to show my face a little bit and not just be this like avatar. It's good to like go interact with some people, I think.
What does that entail to be sponsored by a poker room? I mean, we've talked to people who are sponsored by online sites before, but I mean, what do you have to do for that?
It's kind of an interesting sponsorship because they have BorgataPoker.com. They're partnered with Party Poker and it's the site that's offered in New Jersey. And it's also a brick-and-mortar casino, which is, like, my home base. So I have, like, a cool sponsorship that's, like, has requirements for playing a certain number of live tournaments a year, patched up, and a certain number of hours online. And it's just, like, any other sponsorship, just being a good ambassador for the site, like, kind of being a little bit customer service when people have problems, making sure I'm available. And I'm playing on that site, like, almost every night, so I'm doing, like, consulting for them where if there's a structure change that needs to happen, I'm on it. If there's a tournament I think should be offered that could get some traction, I'll propose it to them. And basically just being a good communicator between the player base who might have suggestions and management who could make changes.
So there's not necessarily like a strong expectation that you're going to be kind of pressing the flesh in the poker room. You sort of have to be there patched up, but it sounds like a lot of what you're doing is...
They're not like, you need to rot away 80 hours a week at 2-5. Like, they were, you know, they're pretty cool as far as, you know, so far. I haven't started with them, so who knows? Maybe I'll be.
Right. But you're not anticipating being a glorified prop.
Right.
They're not, like, telling you what games to play or...
No, not at all.
What goes into, I guess you haven't actually started doing this yet, but... You mentioned having an idea or making suggestions about, you know, here's a tournament that I think would go well into this time slot. I mean, how would you come to a decision like that or have an idea like that? Would it be based on something someone suggested to you or?
Yeah, like I've been playing online for a long time, so I've gotten to play on like a ton of different poker sites, and there are tournaments that are like people's favorite on every other site. Like when Full Tilt used to exist, there was that like ridiculously gambly midnight like 200 that had like, it was like a hyper, but it was a day saver and you could win like 10K at the end of the night and every tilted gambly person would be playing it because you're like, oh my God, I lost 5K today, please help. and things like that. So like, I'll remember tournaments like that and I'll suggest them. Obviously New Jersey is a smaller player base, so it has to be like a smaller buy-in. But we have a Skype group of all like New Jersey MTT players who will like bring up their suggestions and problems. And I'll like hop in there whenever I can and just like read what people wrote. And my housemates play, so like anytime there was some kind of issue that they had, I listened to them. So it's kind of like, it's not that difficult to like have an idea of like what needs to be changed. I think if you were management, it'd be very difficult to have this outlet of like all these people telling you their problems. Like, you're only going to hear when you're doing a crappy job and like the sky is falling. These people are just like playing every day and like, oh, wouldn't it be nice if we had like a $50 turbo at 10 p.m. or whatever. So that's kind of it. That's the idea, is just to like make sure there's somebody in between like just playing and running the whole site.
My concern in these kind of situations is always that it's the, I guess, mostly professionals or at least serious players who either have the best access to someone like you or maybe even know that a person like you exists to communicate with. I mean, is there anything that you do or plan to do to kind of make sure that you're getting a perspective from more recreational players as well?
I think Twitter is actually like really great for that, because like I'm really accessible and I'm not too cool to like read everyone's comments. So like, I think most people interact with me on Twitter are like my friends or like rec players. So when I used to work for Party Poker, I'd get suggestions on there all the time, or like I felt like I was customer service sometimes, because they'd say, hey, I tried to use this ticket that was in my inbox, it's not working, and like I would go make sure that it reached the right person who could help. The other thing is like, I do like playing live cash, especially I'm not some like baller who's playing like 10 to quarter every single day. And I play with people who are like not pros. You know, like I'm playing 2-5 most of the time. Like I'm going there and just like hanging out. So a lot of people who are playing that are like the most casual players. Like they might hop in like our $100 nightly online or something. But like those are people I talk to all the time that like would definitely have suggestions about like semi-pro type players. I don't think I'm just catering to like the super serious players. But I could see how, like, that's actually a really good point, though. There needs to be, like, some kind of outreach to the players who are just, like, coming home after work and, like, throwing $50 on the site.
I mean, I guess there's a question of whether there really needs to be. Like, it seems to me, and I'm not real on top of these debates, but it seems to me like there's some actual debate going on in the poker world about, you know, to what extent the sites should be catering to pros versus recreational players, or the extent to which their interests might differ. And I guess, you know, recently PokerStars has taken a pretty high profile stance on that question. But
it's been brutal. I kind of feel removed from it because I just haven't been out of the country playing in like what, maybe 2 years, but this has been brutal. Like, I think it's mostly because we've looked at Stars as like, they are always doing everything right. They're always making sure they're making the best decisions for the game. They weren't greedy. They were, you know, they would always listen to pros. They had a lot of people, like they would invite people to Isle of Man to voice their concerns. And, you know, these people who were going there were on 2+2, scooping up as many suggestions as they possibly could for changes that need to be made. Like Gags went and did a great job, in my opinion. And over the last just couple of years, it's like changed vastly, and it's been a little bit upsetting that the leader in online poker is now not so player friendly, sometimes rude. On Twitter, I'll be reading comments and I'm like, oh my God, like they don't care. Like they have to put themselves in the player's shoes who just lost 50K of their expected income the next year that they thought was like guaranteed to them. And maybe just like have a little more empathy before responding. Yeah, it's a little bit alarming. And like, I'm hoping that the other sites that are, you know, second and third in the world don't realize that they can also treat us like that. Because basically we don't have a choice. Like people who are playing poker for a living online, like they just need to play on these sites. There aren't like five other options unless they're going to go sit and make vastly less per hour playing live cash or something, or like, or just gambling in 10K EPTs and stuff. They don't really have too much of a choice.
Well, speaking of Twitter, the other kind of big drama bomb lately, in addition to the Marty Derbyshire stuff, is the Mike Dentali, Kate Hall, Twitter feud, which hopefully is spiraling into some sort of 10K fight, yo. have you been paying attention to that?
Oh, yeah. Dude, this is awesome.
So good. Anything that involves both Mike Dentali and Kate Hall is just going to be so good.
Could there be two more different human beings on the planet?
No. 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 All right. So what do you think? Put a line on. So as we talk, Mike has accepted Kate's challenge on Twitter, or appears to have. Kate has tweeted about this. Please put a line on this, Jamie. What are the chances that this match actually happens?
So small. Just come on.
I agree. I agree.
I love Kate. We are very good friends. And we're texting about it. And I was like, I just think she's so funny. Because I'm like, you're so smart. Like, painfully smart. But, like, there's this, like, cute, like, naive part of her that thinks that, like, this is going to happen. Like, she's just so hopeful it's going to happen. I'm like, look, like, this is the kind of thing, like, if you've been in poker for a little while, you're just realizing that these, like, pissing matches just always end in, like, both people being kind of embarrassed and moving on and everyone talking about it. Like, that's what almost always happens. Then every now and then you have, like, Olivia Bousquet beating someone almost to death. So, like, yes, once in a while, it is going to happen. But in this case, though, like, as her friend, I was like, dude, you have just so much to lose because people respect her and think she's, like, very smart. And I just feel like going into the match like that, where, like, people expect you to crush the other person, yeah, like, her expected dollar value, her EV is very good in that way. But her, like, life EV is so low in this situation, because if she loses, which, like, I don't really know how to calculate it, but I know that, like, a heads up cash game, like, freeze out sort of thing, like, is not going to be like 90-10. It might be like 60-40. So, like, 40% of the time your ego takes such a huge hit, you feel horrible about yourself, people will needle you to no end. That's like,
literally, maybe Dentali will be a gentleman about it.
That's what I mean. It's just, like, tough for her. I don't know. Maybe I'm not, like, such a poker player then, because, like, I would sacrifice some dollar EV just to make sure that I'm not, like, miserable over the whole situation.
Yeah, the 10K seems like actually kind of a small number for this, if that's still the number they're at. Maybe I'm not on the most recent thing, but I think you're right that for whatever her expected value is there, it very well may not be worth it just kind of reputationally. I think if she could get them up to like 100K, then I'd be willing to like eat crow if I lost.
She's so hilarious, though. Like, I'm not used to like women being like so, like, she just doesn't give a shit. It's great. Like, I'm not used to it. I'm used to us, like, having to couch our, like, opinions on things in, like, a nicely worded tweet or something. And she's just calling him a bitch. She's like, escrow the 10K. How long do you need to scrape that up? Like, it is amazing. I just find her so funny. And, like, the people who hate her, I just don't understand. I'm like, dude, if nothing else, she is doing her best to entertain you all. So be thankful.
Yeah. I would not let him choose the dealer, by the way.
Oh my god, that's the thing too, like,
allegedly, like, you know.
Yeah, like, I mean, if when there's smoke, there's fire, right? And there's, like, there have been rumors, so it's like, I don't know, I just wouldn't, I wouldn't accept this match. I was saying to her yesterday that it would remind me of, like, watching the Hillary and Trump debates, where, like, you're watching it and you're like, you know, most people are like, oh my god, like, he's never answering a question, this is hilarious, she's crushing him, whatever. And then you go home and you read Trump won. I'm like, oh my god, it could be just like that. Like, she might play him in this match and, like, all he'll talk about is how lucky she ran or how it's a setup and whatever. And, like, I don't think he could ever accept defeat. I think that no matter what, you know, she might win money in this situation, but it's just going to create more problems for her.
Yeah, I had the same sort of analogy popped into my head where I was like, even if this did somehow go forwards, I can only imagine him just trying to lay all the groundwork to make excuses for his loss, that, you know, it was rigged, or, you know, she has all these advantages coming in, or just whatever. Like, I think I would expect him to handle it basically the way Trump has.
Yeah, he just talks about how good she runs all the time. I'm like, she has clearly, like, I can look at hand histories and, like, she's clearly run above expectations, like, deep in tournaments, but she's always there deep in tournaments. So, you know, like, saying someone ran good doesn't mean they didn't play really well, too. Like, but he seems, like, to always attach so much weight to, like, the fact that somebody had aces versus kings at a final table or something. Like, his like, view of poker and probability and all this is always an interesting read on Twitter.
I was interesting what you said about feeling like women generally have to sort of couch their opinions in a carefully worded tweet or something, because as much as I love your Twitter feed, I don't know that I would describe it exactly that way.
What are you saying? But I do, I mean, if you saw Ben Wolodowski making fun of me, he's like, send me all the drafts in your draft box.
Yeah, I would pay a good bit of money for the drafts, for some Jamie Kirsten.
No, drafts. No, seriously, like, we can do this. It's Christmas. I'll contribute to $30, maybe more, if you're willing to release your drafts box. That's pick a charity.
Like, yeah, you might look at that and be like, you don't seem to really censor yourself all that much. And I'm telling you, I censor myself a lot.
What is your charity of choice?
Any kind of animal rescue right now. I think what Dan Smith is doing is pretty awesome, though. I made just a small donation yesterday, but he put a lot of effort into picking charities that do the most. And there are ones, like, I was just amazed that the Against Malaria Foundation was one of the top ones on his. It's like $2.50 to buy a kid a bed net that prevents bugs from getting him in the middle of the night. And malaria is just rampant. So, like, you're literally spending $2 to save someone from dying a horrible death. And things like that, you're just like, it's incredible how much you could do with so little money. And that's what I mean. Like, poker has opened my eyes to a lot of things, like a lot of these charitable efforts. Like, my old way of, like, giving back was I do a few pro bono hours, and I would volunteer at a soup kitchen, but you're helping like 20 people, you're not doing a whole lot. Like, this is like you're spending very little money and, like, very much changing people's lives. So yeah, I don't know. So my charity choice is always animal rescue type things, but I'm realizing that, like, there are tons of kids who could really use help more. The, like, poker has helped me look at, like, bigger picture stuff and to really make sure you're giving your money to, like, causes that can do the most good. I used to just give to causes that were, like, that I could see, you know? Like, I'd go adopt my adorable puppy at the Humane Society and be like, I'd like to contribute to the Humane Society because I got this awesome dog. But, you know, that is good too, to, like, be able to see, you know, tangible things that you can help. But I think it's really cool that these people are willing to do so much research into, like, if you want to donate $100, what is the most good that you can do with this $100 to the people who need it the most right now? I think that's a really cool thing. And, like, I think poker is great for that. And, like, Reg Charity and Dan Smith's, like, 175K match donation thing. I think they did a really good job of that, of just, like, making sure that they're bringing, like, the logic of poker into charitable giving, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah, I've been kind of torn about this myself, because I mentioned before doing the stuff that I've done with the Urban Debate Leagues. And, you know, that's sort of, like, for me personally, it's something that, you know, I'm passionate about and I kind of enjoy. And so, like, I put more time into that than I would if I were, you know, volunteering in a soup kitchen or something like that. But in terms of, like, encouraging other people to donate to it, which I do from time to time, which I'm actively doing right now. But I'm always sort of like, well, if you're, it's hard for me to tell people to give money to that rather than, like, the Malaria Foundation, for instance. If it's the case where they're not going to give money anywhere and they're more doing it, like, as a favor to me, then, you know, I guess I would direct it here. But if it's just, like, I have a pile of money I'm going to donate, where should I put it? It's hard for me to tell them not to just, you know, do Give Directly or Malaria Foundation or something.
Exactly. And it's funny because you have to just, like, you have to do what inspires you also. Like, if I was a lawyer, if I wanted to do the most good I could in the world, I would have worked my butt off and just, like, been a partner by now and be making tons of money and just donating it, you know? Like, but I would be the most miserable person ever. So, like, who knows if I could even keep doing that without falling into depression and quitting altogether. And poker is, like, if you do well enough where you have some extra money and you could donate and makes you feel good, then do that. For me, I'm like, I kind of want to donate money to things like the malaria, against malaria foundation, but donate my time to things that I could like see helping. Like that's kind of like, I knew I was going to talk about Crouton because I always do in every interview. But I just love my dog so much, and like I'm so grateful that the shelter treated him so well and that they do such a good job of getting dogs adopted. My new effort is making a blog where I'm just going to try to be like funny and entertaining and like take pictures of all the dogs there, because their websites are so like bare bones, pun unintended that time, but they have like pictures of the dogs that are like, they're kind of just like sitting in their cages. It's not like a Sarah McLachlan commercial where they look super sad and you want to adopt them. They just don't look like anything. They're just like quick pictures that someone clearly took and just threw up there to be like, this is the dog we have. So I'm planning to go to the one first that where we got Crouton, take pictures and little videos of these animals and just make funny captions, like kind of along the lines. Do you guys know the Twitter handle Dog Race?
This is what I wanted to ask you, Abba. This is like the number one question for Jamie Kerstetter. What is it like to have your dog rated by We Rate Dogs?
Oh my God, it was so awesome. I've never gotten more notifications. Like he got like 800 retweets or something. Like my phone was like losing battery power because of how many people were interacting with the dog. So that was so cool. But that actually like factors into my idea here. Like that kid does such a good job. He built that Twitter handle into like one of the funniest things ever. And I was like, what if we just take these pictures from Humane Society, give these dogs more of a personality and like write jokes about it, and I could like make a blog and I could tweet it once in a while and just give people a reason to like fall in love with the animals instead of just looking for the cutest youngest dog they could find.
So this is great. Let us boost the signal a little bit. What's the shelter?
The shelter, it's the Humane Society of Atlantic County. Okay. It's right by Parada. They're awesome. So if anyone is local and looking for pets, they are so awesome. The one girl who's like giving me Crouton, they named him Bosco, so I don't know if they're going to like it that I renamed him. She's handing him over and she's tearing up. Like she's been taking care of him for like 2 weeks and was so attached that she was like tearing up while she was handing him over. And she's like, send in pictures, like let me know how he's doing. Like they love animals so much there that like I couldn't recommend a place higher. So hopefully this website will get a few more dogs adopted, and I don't know. It's just like a little thing where I'm like, I just feel like it's something that I'd be inspired to do and help with. So like if it works, awesome, I'll feel great. If no dogs get adopted, I wasted what, like 20 hours trying to build this website. It won't be a big deal.
Yeah. Well, good for you. That sounds fantastic.
Thanks. So you guys want a puppy or what?
I occasionally try to do, much like you, we got an adult dog from a really great rescue, and I try to do what I can to direct some money their way, and like I definitely sympathize, right? Because the level of attachment to and gratitude for the shelter in this organization that I feel is very, very, very high. I just think they're great, and I think that animal rescue is an important cause, and I am all about that. So if you're ever doing like a fundraising thing with the Atlantic something Rescue League?
Humane Society of Atlantic County.
Humane Society of Atlantic County. Please let me know. I'd be happy to help.
That's awesome. Thank you. There's some ridiculous stats that are like really sad. Like pit bulls get put down more than any other dog, and that's what Crouton is. He's like half pit. They called him a lab mix when he was like.
That's very standard. That's very standard.
Shit. He is not a lab mix. They'll also take like dogs that are 2 years old and be like, puppy. You gotta just get people to see the pictures and get them in the door. Like you don't go to a shelter and decide not to get a dog. Like that's not a thing that I could do. So it's like, if you lure me in there with some like small white lie, I think it's totally fine. But a million, it was something like 1.2 million pit bull breeds get put down a year, something like that.
Yeah.
Something that was horrifying, and I didn't even read the rest of the article because I'm like, this is just the most miserable thing ever. Any little things that we could do to help, like just don't ever buy a dog from a puppy mill, pretty much.
Yeah.
Make sure. Did you see actually Senator Lesniak passed a bill? He's awesome, by the way. Do you guys know him in New Jersey?
I don't.
I know the name, but I don't know much about him.
Okay, he's a proponent of online gambling of every kind, and he loves animals. So we're like, we follow each other on Twitter now. It's a beautiful friendship. but he just got a bill passed that no new pet stores can sell any kind of animal except for ones that came from shelters. So that he's doing his best to make sure that like no more animals are bred in puppy mills to just be sold before these other dogs get adopted.
No, that's great. I mean, I'm always worried about unintended consequences of stuff like that, but I'm all about that cause. All about it. So
we got no more Twitter drama. We got nothing to talk about.
So what's it like to be in the booth with David Tuckman? You got to do that last year. You announced a final table. You were really good at it, by the way.
Oh, thanks. He's awesome. He's really good at like keeping everyone on task and while still not being boring. Like that's why I think he's like unique. There's usually someone who's like, hey, guys, there's a flop. Like, this is what, you know, what do you think his range is? Whatever. Like, he's good at keeping us on task, but while still also, like, having a good sense of humor, not being afraid to, like, needle people. And he also is unique because he just knows everyone. So, like, he can just get whoever he wants to come commentate for an hour. He's had, like, Scott Siever in and, like, people who just don't do anything for free. You know, they're not going to like give away their poker strategy for free anywhere, and he somehow lures these people in to help him. So I don't know. I think he's awesome, and it's his birthday today, so happy birthday, Chuck.
Yeah, happy birthday. I think he's one of the most underrated people in poker, and what he does every summer is, I think, really, really good, and especially compared to a lot of other poker commentary you see. The quantity quality combination that he produces is really impressive.
That's what I'm most amazed by. I'm like, wow, the 30th day that you're in this booth, you're still like super excited that this like guy who's played his first tournament is at the final table. And he actually is. He's not like bullshitting.
Yeah.
He's just like, he'll read the backstories of these people and be like super amped up about everything. And like, there'll be a cool hand that plays and he wants to talk about it for an hour. And I'm like, my 30th day in the booth, I would just be like, God, I hope the short sack loses every time we're out of here.
Not that it's really anywhere near the same level of fun, but when I was the year that I was sponsored by PokerStars, doing like sort of like hosting final tables of high profile tournaments was occasionally one of the jobs. And so, I mean, you're just doing like very occasional like chat box commentary, and mostly you're not supposed to be like, you know, disturbing the players or whatever, so it's not nearly as interesting as like commenting. But yeah, I definitely was like, come on, just go all in, just call him, please eliminate it. You just like, I kind of have to sit there and like be available in case they want to make a deal or something to like notify, like you don't even like handle the deal, you just like notify support that they want to make a deal, but you just kind of had to like be alert for 3 hours or however long the final table would take.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot of glory in being like the mod at a online final table. You only like, people only know you're there if you mess up really bad. Like the guy who's like, congratulations, true teller, you're in seventh place or whatever it was, where like five people cashed. That was that huge one, right? The 100K at Stars, like they're just unintentionally needling like all the final tables.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, it's such a big deal because, you know, I don't know if I ever did Sunday Million, but some like, you know, second tier WCOOP events I would do or like that kind of stuff where it's like, it's such a big deal for the people who are there. And it's such like, oh, you're just like constantly checking your watch and you're like, come on, guys, can we get this over? some more Twitter drama?
Well, we've almost taken a full hour from her already, so.
Yeah, that's true. We can let her off a few minutes early.
Yeah. I think you're officially a friend of the show now. You came on the show, you learned what we were all about, and then for some reason you came back on the show voluntarily. So thank you very much. You're officially a friend of the Thinking Poker Podcast.
Problem.
Well, on short notice too. Usually it kind of takes like a week or two of cajoling before I can get people on, and she was in within a matter of days.
Yeah, it's no problem. I'm not very busy over here, you know. I'm like, my schedule at night, I start playing at like 7 p.m. and finish at like 2 a.m. So like every day I'm just kind of like milling around until like 7. So I'm not really, you know, I'm not really missing much by taking an hour with you guys.
So what else are you doing during that time? Playing with Crouton? Yeah. What are your hobbies?
It's almost all Crouton all the time. But yeah, I don't know. I try to travel around a lot. Oh, that's something I should mention. I'm going to Hard Rock Tampa next week for their Winter Open, and I haven't been there yet, but like Hard Rock Tommy has been asking me to go there probably 20 times, and I'm finally getting a chance to go down there, so that should be cool. Yeah, my hobbies are pretty much just traveling. Like, I just, when I'm at home, I'm just grinding and playing with Crouton and looking at the next poker series.
Nice. And did we get book recommendations from you the last time we had you on?
Oh, man. I'm trying to think. I haven't, you mean like a poker book?
Preferably not, really, but whatever you want to.
Oh, good. Then I can do it. Yeah, I was like, I haven't read a decent poker book in a long time. I try to, like, find other methods of learning, but non-poker books. I'm still hooked on, like, anything Chuck, I can never say his last name, Palahniuk.
Oh, yeah. I was like, Klosterman's not that hard to pronounce.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh yeah, I like Klosterman, too. What was that one called? Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs or something?
Yeah.
Him, Klosterman, yeah, I like him, too, but, no, this guy is the one who wrote, like, Choke and Lullaby, and he writes, like, really, really disgusting science fiction-y, like,
Fight Club, right? Didn't he write Fight Club?
Yeah. Yep. So, like, his books are, like, somewhat based in reality, but they're usually, like, pretty either gross or horror-ish. But, yeah, that's currently, I guess, my recommendation. How about you guys? Anything good?
The main person that we always push is David Foster Wallace.
Mm-hmm. I'm preparing for a reading project I'm doing in 2017, which I have not announced yet. I'm doing a reading project in 2017 that takes some preparation. I'm going to read 2017 sonnets and tweet about them. So I'm reviewing.
That's the most random goal. Like that, you might. I mean, is this something that a lot of people are doing?
No, I just made it up.
Does that sound like something a lot of people would do?
No, that's what I was saying. I'm like, is this some, like, sonnet movement I don't know about?
No.
Or no, like, maybe are you the only one doing this?
I'm probably the only one doing this. I have to be the only one doing this.
But, yeah.
I'm a little bit rusty on, like, what all the different feet are called and some of the terminology, and I want to be able to talk about them in a way that'll fit in 140 characters, so I need some technical vocabulary for that.
That's a lot of sonnets per day.
It's like six per day, but like, yeah, I mean, I'm not gonna like scan the meter of everyone and then like upload it. Like, I'll try to figure out what's going on, but I'm not gonna. These will not be like full essays. I mean, they're 14 lines each. So yeah. That's.
I kind of want to issue a challenge to you. When you're like reviewing these sonnets,
yeah.
I want your tweets to be in haiku form.
Ooh, that would be hard. That would be hard. Not sure I can do that on the normal account, but I'll try, because you're very good on Twitter, and I trust your I trust your Twitter sense much more than mine, so I'll try to throw in some haiku content there.
Yeah, good luck. I said this to Paul Orstein. Do you know him? Or no, he used to work for Bluff. He actually just got hired by Poker Central. He's awesome.
Yeah,
he was
yeah.
a reporter and stuff. I made it like as a joke at one point. I was like, yeah, you should just like write all of your hand histories like on the blog in haiku form. You can never suggest something as a joke to him because he will do it. He was like writing haiku. Another time where like him and Molly and Mosey were covering it was a Runga Gear stop, I believe, and just jokingly I said something like, yeah, you guys should see how many times you could say some certain word, and then all of a sudden like he's doing it. Like words that have nothing to do with poker, like I don't know, try to think, like if you were just like, hey Paul, try to work sonnet into most of your posts, he'd do it.
I probably don't need to tell you about this, but I've always been amused when you know, judges write decisions in your poetry or something like that.
Yeah, it's not often, but like, yeah, don't. I mean,
yeah, I've seen just like bone random, like, hey, this is funny. Check that, you know, like the clickbait type things. I've seen some pretty funny like judicial decisions that were written in.
Oh, yeah, verse. I remember in law school we'd be like we were all dorks. We're like circulating around the ones that are really funny. Like it would always be boring. Like you're reading case law and it's like boring, 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 and then you'd find one where the judge was like super amped up about the case and would be like, the most colorful language and like putting way, way, way too much personal opinion into it, and it would be like it's like a breath of fresh air. Compared to like all the other stuff you read, it would be cool if they did that like in hand histories, like if they were like tournament updates, live updates, if like the writers ever just went on like a ridiculous tangent, I would love to read that more. Like don't leave out the actual hand history, but like I kind of like it when they're like talking about the ridiculous clothes the person's wearing, or like they put colorful language into like, you know, how long they tanked for or whatever. Like I think that's cool, and like they'd probably like their jobs a lot more if they had a little bit more creative freedom to not just like you know, be so, like, mechanical. Like, this is the flop, this is the turn, this is how much the bet was. If they, like, made it a little more fun, I think it would be cool.
Now, I do find it amusing to see them just kind of, like, strain for new ways of saying bet, you know, without just, like, constantly using the word. Yep. Fires the chips into the pot, shovels the chips into the pot.
Yep.
Wager, yeah, just...
And so it's like, the dealer fans the flop. I'm like, why don't we just have, like, a form that puts out the hand in the middle, and all the colorful language can be about, like, the players themselves or, like, something.
Yeah.
You know? I feel like it would save them a lot of time, and it would be less boring.
And, like, the energy they spent doing that, they could spend actually getting the hand history right, which...
Yeah. I hate writing on bloggers, because I don't think they get paid a lot, and it's, like, everyone's favorite thing is to complain about how bad they are at, like, you know, just transcribing the hands. I hate that, because, like, I don't think they get paid tons, so it's, like, picking on them is bad, but if they... I don't know. Somehow, it, like, I think they could probably make more money if people were, like, sharing these hands more, right? Yeah, like, if we were posting these all over the place, they'd be getting more ad revenue. Maybe, I don't know, maybe there's something to, like, letting these people just go nuts.
I think that's right. And, like, I mean, my complaint, I think, is largely with, like, the training and infrastructure around it, because mistakes happen that just couldn't happen if they were getting trained. Like, I don't know. Like, I think... for you, it would be almost impossible to count a stack wrong. Like, you just can't look at a stack of red and not see $100, right? And yeah, multiplying by 20 and then doing some addition, it seems like an opening for somebody to write better tournament updates by making sure that people know what's going on.
Right, and knowing, like, just having played a bunch of poker, you, like, know when a hand is interesting and when it's not. Like, you wouldn't just report a hand because you wrote it down. You know, you'd be like, well... this is pretty standard. This isn't going to be interesting.
Yeah.
But you might move to a table where, like, a pot isn't necessarily very big, but, like, the hand is super interesting. Like, it would be nice to have, like, ex-poker players or people who are playing poker who are, like, you know, covering the hands at a certain stop. You can always tell. Like, I can tell when someone plays poker or not based on, like, how they're writing a hand history out.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, it's all going to come down to, like, if they're getting paid enough. Like, if these people aren't getting paid enough, then, like, they don't have any reason to improve, and it's, like, just totally not their fault. Like, you're going to put in whatever effort is required to keep your job, and that's it, if you're not ever going to, like, be able to make a lot of money or move up.
And it also means that we're not the audience if that's what's going on. Like, if they're just trying to improve SEO for poker bet or something, then like, really, they don't care if we're reading it and getting something out of the hand histories, right? Like, and it seems like that might be what's going on sometimes.
Yeah, makes sense.
Well, thank you again for coming on the show. It's been a pleasure. We hope you'll come back. I mean, someday.
Thanks for having me. Next time we got to store up a bunch more Twitter drama before I come back on. It'll be more interesting.
Yeah.
I hope Nick Tantali doesn't, like, beat me up or, like, eat me for protein or something. You know.
Yeah. Good luck there. Good luck there. I said some aggressive things also. So. You know,
he's gonna, like, give you a wedgie or, like, put your head in the toilet, you know.
Well, thanks again, and have a good evening. Good luck with everything.
Thank you. Have a good one.
Take care.
Bye.